are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, April 17th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, journalist David Dayan on the most powerful staffer in Congress who is not on your side. Also on the program today, Jeff Sessions gone but not forgotten. Attorney General Bill Barr seeks to end bail for officially credible asylum seekers. Meanwhile, Donald Trump vetoes a bill to end U.S. involvement in the Yemen war, his second veto. The first act of Congress in a long time to end our involvement in a war. Meanwhile, Republicans are blocking the tightening of vaccine laws across the country as we have various outbreaks of diseases because of anti-vaxxers. White House seeks to fuel a constitutional crisis over congressional's subpoenas. And breaking, a $200 billion revenue per year insurance company is against Medicare for All. The Natural History Museum cancels its fascist exhibit by disinviting Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro.
Dave Rubin's dumb.
Same-sex partners much more likely to be denied loans, study finds, and Israel deports a human rights worker via their anti-boycott law. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Wednesday, April 17th. We are rushing headlong into what I anticipate will be one of the least relaxing vacations I've had in the history of all the vacations I've ever had. In fact, tomorrow will be our final day. As you know, Passover starts Friday night, and I will be traveling with my children to visit relatives for Passover. And then later in the week, I'm going to take them solo to Florida. And
Oy
is right. I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to try and entertain a 6-year-old and a 13-year-old simultaneously over the course of 5 or 6 days, but that is virtually impossible. So cannot wait to get back. And, of course, the Mueller report will come out probably about an hour after we start vacation, which is usually the way it is. I anticipate a lot more news happening over the next week and a half. I'm going to do my best to get on YouTube Live over the course of the week if there are breaking stories. I'm going to do my best, and it's going to involve a certain amount of patience from my kids and patience, frankly, from you, because there could be opportunities for you to see my children as they demand things from me over the course of that week. But we will get to that. Also, I want to just do one update on a story that we had covered in Vegas. I interviewed a woman who had who is running an organization, was seeking to her last name escapes me already, to extend Bridie Farrell. And Bridie Farrell has been working on an organization called New York Loves Kids, which was advocating for the passage of the Child Victims Act in New York State. Prior to, I think it was signed maybe weeks ago. Prior to weeks ago, the statute of limitations in New York State, if you were sexually assaulted as a child, was somewhere around 30, age 30 or so, if you were, was 23 for both civil and criminal punishment. So if you turn 23 without bringing a case against the adult that assaulted you when you were a child, you had no other opportunity. Now, that's absurd. Anyone who was a victim of any type of sexual assault will immediately understand how difficult it is for people to bring charges, just broadly speaking, but never mind a child, and to even become sort of able to process the whole thing by the time you're age 23 is, I don't want to say virtually impossible, but extremely difficult. And for 10 or 11 years, this organization has been attempting to push this legislation. But because of the Republican dominance, I shouldn't say dominance, but because Republicans owned the Senate, largely because of the IDC, for years, that bill could not pass, which would extend the length of the statute of limitations. And when the IDC was defeated last year, this bill progressed through the New York Assembly and Senate and was signed by Andrew Cuomo. It is now the law of New York State. Now you have until age, I think it's 30, 35 or so, to file criminal charges. If you're assaulted from February of this year on as a child, you have till age 35 or so to file criminal charges, and I think 52 to bring civil charges. There is also a one-year grandfather for people who were sexually assaulted as a child and the statute of limitations had run out. There's a one-year period, which I believe started maybe March 1st, where they can file charges. The update is a new victim has gone public in the Jeffrey Epstein case, filing a sworn affidavit in federal court in New York Tuesday saying that she was sexually assaulted and her then 15-year-old sister molested by Epstein and his companion, Ghislaine Maxwell, in 1996. And I suspect that this move, this is happening because of that law. I'm not 100% sure of it, but I believe so. The assault, I don't know if it took, she reported her assault to New York police in 1996. Documents released April 1st make reference to Farmer having been interviewed in 2006, 2007. Farmer, now 49, said the FBI did not take any action against Epstein and Maxwell. So the statute of limitations, I think in this case, are already having an impact. So just to give you an update on the implications, I don't know that we ever mentioned when we said defeat the IDC in New York State, whatever it was, a year ago, that anybody had contemplated this. But that's one of the implications of defeating the IDC and having Democrats control all branches of government in New York State. We will see others, too, around the country. Republicans are blocking tightening of vaccination laws because at the end of the day, they're a little bit more anti-vaxxer than perhaps on the left. Certainly within the Republican Party reflects its most marginal views on the right. more so than the Democrats do. That's just the bottom line.
Could there be some financial ties there as well?
It's conceivable, but I don't know what they would be. I don't know how that would work out. I mean, certainly the drug companies want there to be more vaccinations. And I don't think that we're at a point where the opting out of vaccinations is costing the drug companies a sufficient amount. They buy the immunizations from the U.S. government purchases the immunizations. I would imagine hospitals, they all buy probably the exact same amount. But it
they're
doesn't
in bed with big wellness.
Right. Exactly. It doesn't make it doesn't just I don't think economically it makes that much of a difference. The anti-vaccine movement at this point. In terms of the bottom line for the vaccination makers. But it only takes a few anti-vaxxers to begin to undercut the effectiveness of the of herd immunity, as they call it.
Oh, yeah. I looked that up the other day because apparently there is a measles outbreak in South Williamsburg.
That's
and
right.
I go through there on the subway on my way to work.
Because of the, I think it's the Hasidic community, there is a significant number of anti-vaxxers in that community. And it's highly problematic. That's why we heard last, a couple weeks ago, there was one up in Rockland County as well, outbreak. And that was also from an Orthodox community up there, and it must have traveled down.
Are there religious reasons for that, or is that autism paranoia?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm not aware of any religious reasons why that would be the case.
I got a very concerned phone call from my mom about it.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm sure you're vaccinated, but I don't know what the efficacy of a vaccination is. I think it's pretty close to 100%. But the issue is if you have a compromised immunity system, immune system, or if you are particularly old or particularly young, can be problematic.
Yeah, I looked this up, actually. They say that if you know you've been exposed to it as an adult, even if you were vaccinated as a kid, you're supposed to get a booster.
Oh, I didn't know that. Folks, the problem that keeps so many businesses from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. Oh, God, do I know this. We have a legacy system on our membership and fans. Fans is great. The legacy system, not so great. But migrating people over, it's very difficult. They have one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory, and so on. It's just a big, inefficient mess that takes up too much time and too many resources, and that hurts the bottom line. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle. It's the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform that gives you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches. Those are all things that I would love to save. By managing sales, finance, accounting, orders, and HR instantly right from your desktop or phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits, comma, Michael.
Sweet. Crush
the comma, the comma Michael part I made up. At netsuite.com/majority. That's netsuite.com/majority to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits. netsuite.com/majority. Also, today, the Majority Report being supported by, in part at least, by Simple Habit. You've heard me talk about Simple Habit. It's a mobile app that provides a massive and diverse library of 5-minute guided meditations. And the Majority Report audience can try Simple Habit totally free for an entire week when you go to simplehabit.com/majority. There's a lot of evidence that touts the benefits of meditating, both anecdotal and, frankly, data. It's true. I've had just about every
data.
Therapist I've been to, and even my doctors now, or my physical doctors, are saying, "You really think about it."
Even them, they're just like, "Jesus Christ, dude."
Yeah.
Sit down.
They have guided meditations for mindfulness, meditations for anxiety, for depression, for when you're having trouble falling asleep, meditations for when you're wanting to overcome procrastination, or for when you have something important going on at work. They have meditations designed for parents. So you can deal with your children. They have meditations made specifically for when you're waking up or your lunch break, any time of the day. As you know, different people meditate for different reasons. Simple Habit is able to cater to just about anyone, regardless of what their goals are with meditation, how much past experience they have with meditation, how intimidated they are by meditating. It's the variety of guided meditations on Simple Habit is what sets it apart, and that's why Simple Habit won the 2018 Google Play Award for Best Well-Being App. It's available on iOS, Android, and web browser, and the Majority Report audience can try it for free for a week by going to simplehabit.com/majority. If you're watching on YouTube or if you're listening by the podcast, look in the show description, below. I don't know how you do that with audio, but below the player, and we have a link there. All right, let's apropos of our guest who's coming on in just a moment to talk about a guy named Wendell Primus, who may very well be one of the largest impediments to Medicare for All in the Congress today. The Republican Party is a big part of it. Now, I guess maybe I should say the House. But here is Fox News doing triage. I am quite convinced that this segment would not have happened but for the, really, from the Fox News perspective, from the president's perspective, from the perspective of anyone who was against single-payer health care, from the perspective of people who are desperate to not have Bernie Sanders be the Democratic nominee and potentially the president of the United States, from all of those people's perspective, the Fox Town Hall was a bit of a disaster for them. Now, there's a little bit of controversy about Bernie and Andrew Yang, and I think Buttigieg is going on shortly. About 10 years ago, there was a concerted effort to convince Democratic politicians not to go on Fox because you did not want to validate their propaganda operation as some type of news organization. But there was a feeling that if you were to go on, you want to undercut their message. And very few people are capable of doing it. That guy, Bregman, who he had on, Rutger Bregman, did it very well. Of course, he ended up getting bumped and but was able to release this stuff. You want more examples of Donald Trump having, issues with what happened on Fox. At first, he was sort of like, and then it started to seep in that it was really problematic for him. And he was on Twitter raging last night. Many Trump fans and signs were outside of the Fox News studios last night and now thriving. Thank you, President Trump, speaking to himself. Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, for the interview with crazy Bernie Sanders. Big complaints about not being let in. Stuff with Bernie supporters. What's with Fox News? I believe it'll be crazy Bernie Sanders versus the sleepy Joe Biden as the two finalists to run against the best economy in the history of our country and many other great things. I look forward to facing whoever me. May God rest their soul.
Wow.
Whoa.
Is that his name for Joe Biden now? Sleepy Joe?
Wait, is that a death threat?
He's just saying, may God rest their soul. Yeah, I don't know.
Just
don't
a debate.
I'm just throwing stuff out there.
Just a debate.
He hopes okay. to get a good night's sleep.
It's just
sleep.
My so words, man.
Fox is in triage.
They need emotional care for him as well.
And the White House must be aware of this. I mean, this is an all hands on deck moment when you send at this stage right now, because you want to this is not when they wanted to roll her out. The Trump appointed bureaucrat in charge of Medicare and Medicaid in the Trump administration, and they're bringing her out now. This is way early for this, way early, much earlier than you would have wanted to. And they actually sit her down with Kilmeade, Brian Kilmeade, right?
Their Medicare expert.
Yeah, their Medicare expert.
Seema Verma is the administrator for Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Seema Verma, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So all this talk about Medicare for all really hits your office specifically. Can that work?
Well, I've been saying that Medicare for all is the biggest threat to the American healthcare system. What we're talking about is stripping people of their private health insurance, forcing them into a government-run program. So this is a bureaucracy that's going to be making decisions about everybody's health care, what kind of benefits that they can have, what kind of medications that they can have access to. And if we look at other socialized countries that have tried this approach, what do we see there? Long wait times, poor quality health care, and that's why those people are flying to the United States to get their health care.
But people say, wow, I'm a senior. I like that. I like Medicare. It's working for me. So why not give it to everybody?
Well, look, as a head of the program, I can tell you that Medicare is a sacred promise that we have made to the American people. They have paid their entire lives into this program. And now we're talking about putting millions of people into a program that was designed specifically for them.
Right.
And what that's going to mean is that they're going to have to compete to get care. That's putting them in line for their care. And I don't think that's fair. And the reality is we're having problems today paying for the Medicare program. And the trustees have warned about the solvency. So just adding more people to the program is just going to exacerbate it.
Right. This is roughly what his plan looks like. Let's just
pause it for 1 second. It will exacerbate it if there is no more funding. But no one has proposed no more funding. Obviously, if anything, it will expand the services for Medicare. And it will put it on more solid financial footing because of the dedicated resources to the entire program.
And exacerbate it.
Right. This is roughly what his plan looks like. Let's just take a full screen of this. Transition U.S. to a single-payer system over 4 years. No premiums, deductibles, only minimal co-pays. Cost estimate $28 to $32 trillion. And he claims that $28,000 is now spent for a family of four for health care. And that $32 trillion will be over 10 years. How does that look?
Well, essentially what this is he's saying we're going to essentially just move all of these costs to the government. But that just means higher and massive taxes for the American people.
Well, again, it is, yes, higher taxes. And Bernie already led with that. So they're really having a tough time figuring this out. Now, Donald Trump is was reported the other day spending a ton of money on Facebook Facebook ads geared towards old folks. On Facebook, and this is going to be what they're going to try and motivate. They're going to say that Medicare for all is going to ruin your Medicare. Now, Seema Verma, of course, was formerly a healthcare consultant to states, teaching them how to get around Medicaid implementation and how to set it up in such a way that you could get a waiver from the government. So that you could actually continue to increase the profits of private insurance. Invisible to the public, wrote Indy Star. Vima's work has included the design of the Healthy Indiana Plan, a consumer-driven insurance program for low-income Hoosiers that's now being touted nationally as an alternative to Obamacare. In all, Vima and her small consulting firm has received more than $3.5 million in state contracts. At the same time, Vima has worked for one of the state's largest Medicaid vendors, a division of Silicon Valley, Genentech Hewlett-Packard. That company agreed to pay Vima more than $1 million and has landed more than $500 million in state contracts. Huh, imagine that.
Synergy.
During your tenure as Indiana's go-to healthcare consultant, I wonder who it was that brought her to the White House, Mike Pence. And because you know why? Because she understands how you can both make money and make money as long as you're taking it from both the, that's what is known as a public-private partnership. And it all ends up in her pocket.
The problem with bureaucrats is they can't take a cut like that.
That's right. But I'm sure it's going to enhance her consulting business when she's done with this. All right, folks, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, David Dayan. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, our next guest has written for every major worthwhile publication in the country. If he has not, then you know it is not a worthwhile publication. He is also, ladies and gentlemen, David Dayan. David, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And not only that.
Why are you so late?
I know. I was late. I apologize. I was trying to set up this piece. But I should also say, author of Chain of Title, which some consider one of the best books on the mortgage crisis that is out there. So if you want to know, if you have not read Chain of Title, you don't know about the mortgage crisis, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
And I should also say, this is public knowledge, right? I mean, that David Dayan is just weeks away of officially taking the title of what? Editor-in-chief?
Executive editor of the American Prospect, available on the web at prospect.org.
This is very exciting. I'm very excited about it. Long overdue. I mean, not necessarily with the American Prospect, but it was long overdue for you to get a role like this. But so, David, let's talk about the piece that you wrote in The Intercept last week about Wendell Primus. Wendell Primus first came to my attention, I think, well, maybe I had heard his name a while back, but most recently he was caught on tape basically telling a room full of insurers, don't worry about Medicare for All.
Yeah. In fact, he's this is almost kind of a roadshow that he has done, not just to insurance lobbyists, but to healthcare researchers. I found a very obscure video of him at a healthcare conference in Irvine, California, where he was making the same points, essentially downplaying Medicare for All, saying the House leadership, the Democratic leadership, would not support it, that they would go instead to try to make improvements to the Affordable Care Act. And this is one of sort of many areas in which Primus, who is the lead health policy advisor to Nancy Pelosi, is one of many areas where he has differed with progressives on these issues.
And that was, that is why we're talking about him, is because of his central role in the,
I think we're talking about him because it's spilled into public view. I mean, you don't normally hear about a staffer in Congress. I mean, that's very unusual that a member of Congress would refer to a staffer by name and in a pejorative sense in saying that they oppose this staffer's ideas. I mean, that just doesn't happen. But Wendell Primus, who has been around for quite a long time, is, somebody told me the term member staffer, that they've been around so long and accumulated so much power and has been given so much power by the speaker that he's almost this unelected voice shaping the direction of Democratic policy, particularly on health care, which, as we all know, is a huge issue for many progressives.
Okay, so I mean, I've got so many questions to ask you about this, but I want to just set the table, get a sense of who he is, and then sort of what the broader implications are of this. But before we go specifically to his history, do we understand do you have a sense of what the relationship is between Pelosi and Primus? Like, is he reflective of what she wants to do, or is he driving the agenda? Like, how does that work?
Well, we can go by her public statements. So in a town hall meeting in 2013, she said, and I'm quoting, on health policy, what does Wendell think is what we say all the time about this issue? So there's no question that Wendell Primus is empowered by the speaker to speak on her behalf, to make policy on her behalf on these particular issues around health care and also around deficits, actually. He's very involved in that issue as well. So we shouldn't see any distance between Wendell Primus and Nancy Pelosi. I think that actually it's kind of a failing on the part of House progressives that they kind of divorce the two, right? They say, we have a problem with what Wendell Primus is saying, but not Pelosi. They are aligned. I mean, they are completely in step. I'm taking them at their word that when Wendell Primus talks, it might as well be Nancy Pelosi talking on these particular issues.
Do you think, and again, we'll get to who Wendell Primus is, because he's also, sure, his history is also sort of fascinating and instructive, I think, of
totally
what is sort of like a generational divide here. But do you think that it's, there is a reason why we are talking about Wendell Primus, why other members like Mark Pocan, who's quoted in your piece, mm-hmm, are talking about Wendell Primus as opposed to Nancy Pelosi? In other words, is it conceivable that there's a sort of a good cop, bad cop quality that's going on here? Is there a conscious decision to sort of make this like, oh, this is like a sort of at arm's length from me? Or is it opponents of Pelosi are using this opportunity to not knock her directly, but rather to say, I'm knocking Primus so that she just gets the message, or what?
Right. I mean, I think it's easier for members to, in this case, go after a staffer rather than the Speaker of the House, who, you know, any member needs the support or at least a working relationship with the Speaker of the House if they want to get their legislation onto the floor and passed. So it's difficult to overtly criticize the Speaker, right? But it's easier to criticize the Speaker's staffer for speaking out of turn or whatever you want to say. I think it's a bit of a cop-out, but, you know, in context, you understand it to a degree that this is a way to express disappointment or dissatisfaction with the direction of the leadership's policies on, particularly around healthcare, without overtly attacking the Speaker. But, you know, my view is that there's just not a lot of distance,
right,
there between Primus and Pelosi.
All right. So let's circle back around to Pelosi. But let's just take this little detour through Wendell Primus's history, because,
sure,
it really is fascinating. This is a guy who in 1996, in response to Bill Clinton's welfare reform bill, resigns in protest. Like,
that's correct.
Like, just even saying those words, resigns in protest, never mind for something that I agree with, is something that's virtually unheard of, it seems like, in politics. Like,
it's a very principled position that you do not see every day. As you said, at the time, Primus was working in the Department of Health and Human Services. So he was on the Clinton administration staff. And when President Clinton said he would sign the welfare reform bill, Primus very overtly and you know, in a public letter said, I cannot remain here. I did this analysis. I think children would be hurt by your welfare reform bill, and I cannot stay. And I cannot disown that analysis regarding the impact of the bill, and I'm going to publicly resign. Now, 5 years later.
Now, wait a second. Let me just say, just to put a fine point on this, this is like the type of guy, like, I would have a poster of this guy in my,
right,
you know, in my apartment,
right,
back in the day.
Right.
I mean,
right,
it's like, you know.
Now, I want to say two things about it, though. First of all, 5 years later, Primus pops up in the New York Times after there were studies showing that the impact of welfare reform was not as acute at least at that time, which was right. during an economic boom.
Right.
I mean, from 96 to 2001 is not sort of a stress test.
In
of
fact,
welfare reform.
Yeah. Well, he's, I guess, 6 or 7 years away from like finding out that, oh, wait a second, maybe I should have.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
Right.
But in 2001, he tells New York Times, welfare reform is working better than I thought it would. And whatever we've been doing over the last 5 years, we ought to keep going. So a little bit too credulous there. It doesn't discount his you know, principled resignation, but it adds some context. The second thing is that, you know, what was he actually doing here? The fight over welfare reform to someone like Primus, who is indicative of a lot of liberals in his generation who were beaten down by the Reagan Revolution and whose goal in public policy is to just sort of hang on to whatever scraps of the welfare state were still left after the ravages of Reaganism. I mean, that is his M.O., and it was his M.O. in 1996 when he did this resignation, and it's his M.O. today. He is someone who thinks that what you do as a lefty is defend what we have now from right-wing assault and never expand anything, because it's, America can't do that. He believes there are limits and constraints to progressive policy, and that the best we can do is make sure food stamps are paid for, and make sure LIHEAP is paid for, and things like that, rather than transform the system.
And to be clear, this is a different story than. God, I can't remember the guy who went around and twisted arms for Medicare D and the Republicans, who was the head of that.
Not DeLay,
but the guy who was head of the committee and literally was negotiating with an insurance company at that time. His name escapes me. I can't remember.
Oh, Billy Tausen.
Yes, it was Billy Tausen. Right, exactly. And
yeah, he was with the pharmaceutical industry, but yeah. Yes.
Well, he was literally...
He ended up becoming the head of pharma.
Of pharma, and he was lobby. Negotiating for that job while he was developing
right.
Medicare Part D,
right.
which was the
right.
drug...
He was a member, not a staffer,
right.
to be clear.
But I'm sure there are examples of staffers who do that type of thing,
yeah.
too, where it's just completely, I'm going to leverage this as a job in the private sector. Is this... I mean, this isn't that type of story, is it?
Yeah, I mean, Primus is not a neoliberal, right? He's not a Clintonite. He is not someone who is really out to reduce the welfare state in meaningful ways, right? He is sort of a center on budget and policy priorities, where he worked for a time in between the Clinton administration and Pelosi, or the Brookings Institution. There's a type of liberal that's just sort of a beaten down liberal. I say the last of the loser liberals in the piece, who just wants to hang on to these little scraps of the welfare state and can't conceive of government doing anything more ambitious than that. This is useful sometimes when, you know, I mean, Primus clashed with Rahm Emanuel during the Affordable Care Act debates. And we remember that Pelosi was the one who said, after Scott Brown defeated Martha Coakley in the seat for Ted Kennedy's Senate seat, and Democrats suddenly lost a 60-vote majority in the Senate, you know, Pelosi was the one saying, we have to keep going, we have to keep going. And Primus was aligned with that, right?
Right. Whereas Rahm Emanuel was saying,
we should
cut back. We should cut back and just go for something, you know, call it the ACA, but let's just do
small. He wanted to stop anything.
Right.
So they're useful. I mean, what Dean Baker, who's a progressive economist, I'm sure you've had on the show,
yes.
has what he said to me for this piece is that, you know, they do great work between the 40-yard lines, right?
Right.
When something might be cut, they're there to tell you why it's important, and it's good and useful, but it's never going to get you into the end zone. It's never going to change the game. They have a very narrow mindset on policy debates, and Primus exemplifies that. And I think that's clear in how he's talked about Medicare for All. I think it's clear in something that I go into detail with in the piece, which is this question of drug price legislation that Primus is spearheading, going against a more aggressive solution put forward by House Democrats, and trying to come up with something that the Trump administration can sign, which seems a little cramped. It's just their mindset. They're beaten down by the Reagan Revolution. There's a historical context to it. They grew up seeing all of these things go away, and they built this sort of defensive crouch. Let's just protect what we have. Let's not make trouble, and let's move forward.
And so, okay, and so we have this. This is obviously a problem because
it's a problem now because we have a new crop, a new generation of Democrats who have much broader policy ambitions, animated by the fact that the last 40 years of this defensive crouch has not worked. Right?
Right.
I mean, we have soaring income inequality. We have 30 million people uninsured. We have many more underinsured. We have stagnant wages that we've had for the last 40 years. People think the status quo and just protecting what we have is not good enough, particularly the new group of Democrats on the left. And now, instead of aligning with a Wendell Primus to fight Clintonites, they are there in open competition with Wendell Primus over the future of liberal policymaking.
Now, I really want to limit this to this conversation to Pelosi in the House. But although you know, there's obviously like a parallel fight happening, you know, in the context of the presidential election with Bernie and Cap. And I don't want to get into that because I need to save that for tomorrow. but like, what is going on? What is going on here with that fight? Because Pelosi is out there making a real show, right? This is not like, oh, she said something offhand and people are blowing it up. There's been a consistent drumbeat from her to attack this new generation that is, you know, led by half a dozen Democratic women, frankly, who are freshmen, at least in the public perspective. But what is going on with that? Like, what is the theory here? Like, why are they being attacked when it was a completely different faction that was literally trying to take her out? In fact, it seems to me that incoming freshmen, the more progressive ones, were the ones who ultimately sort of like shored up her support. What is going on? Is this for show? Is this for the protection of some of these blue dogs who won in 2018, where you had like a lot of purple districts turn, you know, a Democrat won in purple districts? Like, what's going on?
Right. I mean, I don't think it's for show. I think part of it is protection of the new Democrat, blue dog, purple state freshman members who represent the margin of the House majority. But I also think it plays back into this situation with Wendell Primus, who views House progressives as people who leadership needs to be protected from, right? This idea that that progressive ideas must be shunned because the best you can do in public policy making is just protect and defend the status quo. And that, you know, we hear about this sort of concept that Republicans cater to their base and Democrats ignore their base, or one fears their base and right. one doesn't, right? And that's, I think, what this is about, right? It's Pelosi, who's comes from the old guard, Primus, comes from the old guard of thinking, that fears moving, you know, an inch down the football field on these various policies. And it's almost a fear of governing in some ways, or at least meeting the political moment. Their particular beliefs about policy have not been updated to match the political moment. I mean, Pelosi is still, you know, petrified of the deficit. She did a
right.
speech last year on the floor of the House praising Pete Peterson, who was this billionaire that, you know, devoted the end of his life to trying to cut Social Security.
Yes.
And she gave a celebratory address yep. on the floor of the House for him. Primus is at the center of those debates, by the way. He constantly talks about the deficit. He was deeply involved in ensuring that there was a PAYGO provision in the House rules that says you can't put a new program up unless you offset it somewhere else in the budget. This is a mindset. This is a worldview. And progressives of the modern era of these new freshmen represent a threat to that worldview. And whether it's sincere a sincere disagreement over policy or a fear about the political ramifications, either way, the functionally it's the same.
Right.
Right? I mean, functionally it that's how it manifests itself. In this tension that you're seeing right now within the House caucus.
Okay, so it leaves me with two questions, but probably more. one is, they're stuck in a specific mindset, right? That is that the Democrats have been trapped in. I mean, you know, back when people were really debating whether, you know, we could call ourselves liberal or progressive, right? And nobody was identifying as a democratic socialist, Bernie would, the most media Bernie would get would be coming on Air America, frankly, and maybe occasionally Democracy Now. These people are stuck in this mindset. Does it inhibit their ability to also wage politics in this era? In other words, like the same sort of fear that they're driven by that makes them sort of ineffectual in many respects and not up to the moment. And this is something that we complained about. You know, you and I could have had this conversation in 2006, right? In 2005, we probably did. About how Democrats were not being strong enough in the face of Republicans, that they were afraid of their own shadow, that they had learned the wrong lessons, that they keep trying the same thing and it keeps failing. You know, now, of course, we have another, you know, decade plus worth of evidence to this effect. But does this mindset also inhibit their ability to win this internal battle?
I mean, I think it's at odds with a growing set of the caucus, and maybe the best way to answer that is with something concrete, and it's around this whole controversy on drug pricing. So last year, Lloyd Doggett, who's a progressive, who is now the chair of the subcommittee on health at the House Ways and Means Committee, he put together legislation allowing for direct negotiation of drug prices in Medicare with the pharmaceutical companies, which is banned right now per that 2002 legislation we were talking about earlier. And what he said is, you know, my bill has direct negotiation And if they can't come to an agreement, the government can make compulsory licenses of these drugs and give them to manufacturers so that they can set, you know, make a generic version that will compete. And that's sort of the whip hand for the government to say, okay, if you don't want to negotiate with us, we'll just take your license and we'll put a generic version on the market. So Primus apparently agreed with that for a little while. And then when Democrats got the majority, he changed. And he went with a new concept that involves third-party arbitration. So the drug companies will put a price up for, and this is only for certain drugs. Drug companies will put a price up, Medicare will put a price up, and the arbitrator will choose one or the other. That's his new plan. And it undermined this work that Doggett had been doing for a year, getting 122 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives on his bill. So now there's this open warfare between a process that has gone through for a year with outside groups and people within the Progressive Caucus and among House Democrats, and Wendell Primus, who kind of big-footed in and said, no, what we want to do is this arbitration, and I'm going to work directly with the Trump administration to try to find a bill that they would support. So, I mean, right there you see sort of how this affects policy. And how this in some ways inhibits policy, because now you have this huge fight within the caucus on something that both parties have said they want to do, which is lower drug prices. I have another follow-up piece to that coming out very shortly that I think I won't scoop myself on. But there are other implications of this that involve stakeholder industries. And how Democrats are aligning, Primus, the Primus Pelosi faction, is aligning with stakeholders in this fight. So that's about all I can say on that.
Well, where does surely the leadership of the Democrats in the House must realize that they won on health care, right? And that they're going to need an issue going into 2020, and are they just thinking that like it'll be enough to say we're going to marginally help Obamacare get better? I mean, is that going to be the pitch?
I mean, that
like,
is
we're
going to
nibble around the edges. Yeah. Like, if you need somebody to nibble around the edges of Obamacare, we're your party.
This is what they're pushing. I mean, they're saying we want. I mean, the legislation they rolled out earlier this year is for marginal improvements to the ACA. On this drug pricing thing, they want a solution that pharmaceutical companies and lobbyists appear to be more comfortable with, this arbitration idea, rather than compulsory licensing. On everything on health policy, which, as you correctly suggest, is what won Democrats back the House, they have sought the incremental option over the wider range.
It's the marginally better deal. That's what we're going to offer them, the marginally better deal.
The marginally better deal. And, maybe 10 years ago that actually, that's kind of what the ACA was, right? So it kind of made sense because it was the center of gravity in the House was closer to that idea, but it's a new generation, and there just aren't, there are a lot of House Democrats that just aren't on board with this go along to get along approach.
Okay, so I want a really clear-eyed vision of how much of this is a new generation, how much of it is pre-existing members of Congress who are more to the left, but a certain sort of subset of new Democrats are just they're ideologically similar, maybe to a little bit to the left, but they're dispositionally much more aggressive and much more convinced, you know, much more bold, I guess, really, for lack of a better term. And so how much of that, like, give me a sense of how of what the dynamic is there, right? Because, you know, a guy like Pocan has been in there for a while, right? And you know, guys like Jim McGovern have been in there for a while. But it's unclear to me, like, where a guy like Jim McGovern, who is saying, like, yeah, don't worry about the pay-go as much because it's just, you know, it's just to provide cover. We can right. always get a waiver. Like, you know, he's clearly, I think his politics are in the right place, but I wonder if his sort of, like, disposition, for lack of a better term, is in the right place. And to the extent that there's that dynamic between these two different groups, is there anybody emerging as a potential, like, a legitimate potential leader? And, you know, I know, like, people listening to this audience are saying, well, you know, AOC, but I'm talking about somebody who has enough experience and enough relationships in there to sort of, like, lock in a vote, but also is, you know, progressive.
Well, I mean, I first of all, Mark Pocan has only been in the House since 2013. So not super long. And the same goes for Pramila Jayapal.
Right.
And who I think is 2016, maybe, is when she got elected. And those two this year became the co-chairs of the Progressive Caucus. And a lot of this reflects that changeover. So prior to this, you know, Keith Ellison was head of the Progressive Caucus. Raul Grijalva had a leadership position there. Lynn Woolsey, even going further back, had a leadership position. And I don't think I'm speaking too out of turn here by saying that the old guard of the Progressive Caucus didn't have a terribly strategic mindset in terms of trying to advance their interests. They weren't as aggressive with leadership. They weren't as aggressive with their own members. I mean, right. I mean, even to this day, there are members of the Progressive Caucus who are also in the New Democrat coalition, which is kind of crazy. But Pocan and Jayapal have taken a somewhat harder line. You saw this last week when Democrats tried to pass a budget resolution that would have given more money to defense spending than domestic spending. And progressives, led by Pocan and Jayapal, said, no, we want parity between those two buckets of spending, and we're going to block this bill on the floor if you bring it up. And ultimately, they had to scuttle that vote, because if they would have put parity on the floor, then New Democrats probably would have blocked a bill on the floor. So the larger point is that there is a divide in the party. There are two almost equally robust factions, the New Democrats and the Progressive Caucus, who are at odds on they have sincere disagreements on policy. And
can you quantify, you know, that? Like, how many are we talking about in terms of, like, actual numbers?
I think the Progressive Caucus is something between 90 and 95 members, and the New Democratic Caucus is something between 90 and 95 members.
Wow.
So, I mean, you're talking about almost the entire caucus in one of those two coalitions.
So,
So
when we hear the DCCC come out couple of weeks ago and say,
right,
if you in any way as a vendor, right, if you're someone who's a campaign consultant, or you're somebody who, like, I make signs for congressional campaigns, or I do fundraising for congressional campaigns, or I do media buys for congressional campaigns, if you are one of those contractors and you work for someone who is a challenger in a primary, you will get cut off from being able to get any general election gigs from the
right.
DCCC, which is, like, basically, I don't know. I'm trying to think of what the equivalent is. It's like, you know, if you, Sam, if you go on any of the, you know, if you go on any podcasts, we're not going to let you go on, go on radio or something like that. Or, you know, I mean, to the extent that there's any value
in
any
of it. The question about that is, to what degree is that just incumbency protection, which is all the DCCC is anyway?
Right.
And to what degree is that ideological? Like, are they going to blackball a vendor who works with a potential primary challenger to Rashida Tlaib?
Right.
Which is likely, because she is a Palestinian American who represents a largely African American community. And in fact, there was a sort of a split between votes for several different African Americans in that primary. This was the race to succeed John Conyers, and that's why Tlaib came on top. She got a plurality, but not a majority of votes. And if one African American Democrat went against her, they would at least have a fighting chance of winning that primary. So is the DCCC going to hold to that? Would they blackball someone who worked with a challenger to Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar or AOC? Or is this just about progressive challenges to incumbent centrist Democrats? So that's the question that remains sort of to be answered. But, you know, once again, there's this divide. And leadership is clearly on the side of the more centrist faction of that divide. And it's led by Wendell Primus, who has this sort of reputation as a liberal lion, but it comes out of a very narrow worldview of what it means to be a liberal. So that's the best way I can describe it.
When you talk to some on the more progressive side, do mm-hmm. How pointed is this? Where are we in the understanding of this dynamic amongst House members, and what are they talking about as what's the next step? I mean, is there, because you're telling me that they're a little, this leadership is a little bit more strategic. So they must have assessed this problem, and their plan is to do X, Y, and Z over how long?
Well, I mean, it starts with the fact that I'm able to get quotes on the record about a staffer to Nancy Pelosi. I mean, the unprecedented nature of that should be understood by everybody. I mean, Mark DeSaulnier, who's a member of the Progressive Caucus, representative out here in California, said on the record, there are some people on staffs who start to think that they have to protect democracy from elected officials. I mean, that's a pretty stark statement that he was making about the role of these member staffers who sort of get too big for their britches. So I think being open about this controversy is a first step, to say that there's a debate here. There's a divide here. There are people who are frustrating progress, and here's who they are. That's a first step. Now, obviously, Pelosi is, which people somewhat, I think, don't remember, Pelosi is term limited now. She cannot seek another term beyond, I believe, 2022 as Speaker of the House. So obviously there is going to be a lot of factional fighting over who will succeed Nancy Pelosi. But, certainly that can be an area where this divide can be managed in some way. I know that. There's this thought that Hakeem Jeffries is being groomed to be the next Speaker of the House because he took the position that Joe Crowley had mm-hmm. before AOC defeated him. I believe that someone like a Jayapal or a Pocan has designs on perhaps becoming Speaker and using their support within the Progressive Caucus to do that. You know, we're a couple elections away from having ultimately to see what that decision is going to be. But what happens in 2020 on the presidential side, who is the leader acknowledged of the party by the vote of the people, is going to play a role in that. And you know, these things will play out. But the fact that this is so out in the open is a departure from, I think, the strategy of previous years.
David Dayen, always, always I learn something from you, and I appreciate it. The piece is Wendell Primus, the most powerful staffer in Congress, represents a general divide, a generational divide on the left. We will link to that at majority.fm, and we'll also link to the American Prospect. Folks, go there, sign up, subscribe to the American Prospect. It's a great deal that's about to become an even greater deal because of its new executive editor.
Let me just make my little pitch that we have very exciting plans for the future of the Prospect. More issues per year, more writers, more content on the website on a daily basis, being part of this really.
What did you do to your phone?
Ideological divide in the party. Me?
Yeah, you just walked away from your phone or something.
Did I? No, I'm here.
All right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can.
Okay.
Give the pitch again.
So, you know, I mean, we have a lot of exciting plans at the Prospect. More content, more issues of the magazine, more of an impact on the web, more writers, and really this fascinating opportunity to be at the heart of this ideological debate on the left, and both a policy and political debate. And we are excited about the future of the magazine. We're in a good position to be part of that debate. And yes, we really covet and require the support of readers to make sure we can continue to bring you this work. So if you are someone who reads me, this is where I'm going to be, and we need your support. And June 1st is when it'll all kick off.
All right, we'll put a link to both those things. David Dayen, always a pleasure. Thanks, man.
All right, thanks.
Bye. So now we are set up to. Gotten one part of what's going on in the political scene on the from the center to the left. And we'll get a little more of that tomorrow. And that is one of the big stories. Now, of course, tomorrow the Mueller report supposedly is going to be released. It's going to be heavily redacted. I don't know if you're going to be able to read any of it. Not clear who it's being released to. I don't know if it's going to be released to the general public. It's going to be sent to Congress, and then, but isn't it? It's going to be generally released. Do we even know?
I have no idea.
Go to fullyexonerated.com.
The Patreon/fullyexonerated.com.
If we have a lot of people who run organizations who listen to this program, and if someone does not have notexonerated.com.
Oh, no, or better yet, fullyexonerated.com.
Oh, you should also just get on that.
NoCollusionWitchHunt.com.
Right, exactly.
TotoWitchHunt.org.
WitchHunt.gov.
WitchHunt.gov. That actually be...
Fuck.
That would be actually great.
So this is going to rename the DOJ.
Yeah, don't give Barr any ideas. Yeah.
Mm. Folks, just a reminder, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com. When you become a member of the program, you support daily content like this, the program we just had today. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you access to all the fun half, and you can carry it around as a podcast. So check it out. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. As always, if you cannot afford it, we do not allow finances to become a bar to entry, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and we will work something out with you. Also, justcoffee.coop, check it out, 30% off this month. You don't even need to use the coupon code majority. And for members, you can always go and check out the podcast listing on iTunes to get a write-up of what deals we may have for you from our advertisers. So you can check it out there. Michael, last night was Tuesday, presumably. Though I have to say, it was sort of clean in here today. So it's almost like, did you guys do the show?
It was almost like a typical Tuesday where we clean everything up.
Almost.
We usually take out the garbage.
Okay.
Recycling.
Yeah, but we recorded ourselves doing it and made it patron content.
Yeah. The cleanup Patreon bonus content. The TMBS school crew cleans up the MR mess.
Yeah, some people are into that. People are sick.
That's awesome. All right. The Don, Richard Wolf, joined us, and we talked about Gramsci hegemony. Got his thoughts on UBI. I did a history of the Third Way and the conspiracy against Bernie, but why the Third Way project is done. And of course, a whole bunch of other, global and economic content, the stuff you always get from TMBS, patreon.com/TMBS. This Sunday, an illicit history of Deutsche Bank that actually does indirectly connect the Nazi money trail to loans to Donald Trump with Corey Pine. It's pretty fascinating, disturbing stuff. Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Thanks to our first 40,000 subs on YouTube. And of course, there are a few left to this Saturday, Bootleg Theater in LA, our second live show with Anna Kasparian, Big Waz, and Nando Vila. See you Saturday.
I think you're trying to say Buttigieg.
The Buttigieg Theater in Koreatown. Yes.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we took a little field trip to the biennial blast that is the Historical Materialism Conference, and we took the opportunity to interview some very exciting, very famous leftists kind of on the fly, at parties, in the hallway, Gonzo style. So we've got just a little sampling here. I won't say them all. We've got George Ticcarello Marr on the coup in Venezuela. We've got Jasper Burns on communization, Michelle O'Brien of the Trans Oral History Project on abolishing the bourgeois family. Virgil Texas clears some things up about what his political tendency is, and much, much more. I also feel like I should plug this show that I'm a part of because I'm pretty excited about it. Katie Halper and Struggle Session are doing a joint live show at Littlefield in Brooklyn, Friday, May 10th. And I'm going to be a guest along with Jake Flores and Matt Taibbi. So it should be pretty cool.
Nice. Where is Littlefield? We'll put her Brooklyn.
It's in Gowanus.
Oh, it's right by.
It's like right. It's pretty close to the Bell House.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Cool. That's awesome. I know that spot.
Matt.
Literary Hangover, if you haven't checked out the Oscar Wilde episode, I mean, pretty much everybody has, but if you haven't, check it out.
Everybody's checking it out.
On Saturday, Looking Back on the War in Spain by George Orwell, an essay where you sort of see some of the early concepts that you might recognize in 1984, like 2 + 2 = 5. Orwell says the one problem with totalitarian lies is that you can't lie. Have lies interfere with military industrial. You need to know what reality is, so that's a tension there. And also why Orwell says the workers, though they aren't international in sympathy often, are the best long-term resistance against fascism.
That sounds very interesting.
A lot of history. Coming back. All right, folks. Things. Take a quick break. See you in the fun half.
méchant ne lui a jamais appris.
Disent oui,
c'est